All right, it looks like we're ready to go. Good afternoon, everyone. Good morning, everyone. The Court of Appeals is back in session. And I'm Judge Flory. I'll be the presiding judge here along with Judges Frisch and Smith. The next case on our oral calendar is in the matter of the welfare of the children of AMB and JMB, court file A20-1152. We are appearing via Zoom here for our arguments today, but our rules are the same regardless of our format, which means each side here will have 15 minutes for your principal argument, and counsel for appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you wish to use that. We are recording the proceedings as we would always do, and so it will be most helpful to us if you could identify yourselves for our record at the beginning of your argument. With that, then, we'll begin our arguments here today, and counsel for appellant, you may proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honors. Opposing counsel, may it please the court, my name is Michelle Olson, and I represent the appellant in this matter. This matter is a case regarding a permanency petition to transfer permanent physical and legal custody from my client, who is the biological father of the children, to the biological mother. The parties were married at the time, and a CHIPS action commenced. The concerns that have been placed are that the court has abused its discretion following the four factors required for a transfer of permanency under the statute, as well as requiring my client to have sex offender treatment as a means to obtain potential parenting time in the future, even though the court has held jurisdiction. The reason for our concern mainly lies in the fact that the court has improperly made findings that do not support its conclusions of law by clear and convincing evidence standard, which is required under 260C, and therefore we are asking at this time to reverse. Specifically regarding the first element and first point of our case is that truly under these petitions, there is a requirement under the juvenile, it's 260C.517A, which requires four different detailed findings on what is considered the best interest on a transfer of custody, which would be how are the child's best interests served, the nature and extent of the responsible social servants' reasonable efforts to reunify, the parents' efforts and ability to use those services, and then the conditions which led to the out-of-court placement. My client is arguing that the district court has not met any of these findings and has abused its discretion for all of them. Regarding specifically the first factor, there is an interesting argument that seems to be in play here of what is the best interest for the children. Now, the interesting part is there is no definition of what best interest is at this time.
So my question, Ms. Olson, is the court found that your client not only had taken pornographic photographs of his 7-year-old daughter and kept them on a computer, but that he also had attempted to groom another juvenile female. How could it ever be in the best interest of a child to allow him to have contact with the children before he addresses those issues found by the court?
Your Honor, I guess relating to the what led to the adjudication does not necessarily mean that a potential transfer is there. That is why we have these determinations and these specific factors. In this specific case, the fact that the court found by clear and convincing evidence that photos had been taken of the child does not necessarily mean that one, a sex offense had actually occurred to the point that treatment would have needed to be made, or that there was any conviction, which leads to a possible Fifth Amendment issue, which is our second point and contention with the court's findings. But the other issue is this claim of grooming a child, a juvenile. At this point, the alleged crime, again, was not a sex offense. And my client had followed what was recommended and what was given in the case plan, the minimal efforts they were. So to say
he did, I mean, that's not what I read in the record. I mean, there were a number of meetings that were scheduled. There was therapy that was required. He was supposed to show up to meetings with the children, and he kept rescheduling or canceling at the last minute.
Your Honor, that is incorrect. My client was never allowed contact with the children. He was never entitled to have that.
I stand corrected, but the other issues where he was required to comply with certain conditions that were set by the court, he did not comply with those conditions.
I would respectfully disagree, Your Honor. The case plan that was required of him was to complete a psychosexual evaluation and to complete a psychological evaluation. He did those two things. He was also not allowed to have contact with the children. Those were the three requirements as listed by the social worker and as testified to in the record. He did both of those things. The concern was that he did them later than what the county believed was acceptable, but that doesn't mean that he wasn't compliant. And then when he did the psychosexual, he was deemed that sex offender treatment would be a benefit to him and that he should do that because he was required to follow the recommendations.
Well, the case plan required a parenting assessment and following the recommendations, signing of releases and cooperation with family group decision-making meetings and following the plans that were made at those meetings. He didn't comply with those requirements. That was the case plan.
So the case plan that was required for the parental capacity was more for the mother. We originally had a parental capacity in the very first setting. The county changed it and asked for a different assessment to be made, which was the psychological and the psychosexual. The case plans were very similar. There was never ever a true case plan between father and the social worker.
Is that because he didn't show up to meetings? He didn't participate with the social worker in helping to develop a case plan?
No, Your Honor. My client requested that his attorney be brought in, and the social worker didn't involve herself in that and basically said it was the appellant's obligation to contact his attorney and set up the meeting and time and didn't follow. Again, the responsibility, that's the responsibility, and one of the factors is reunification, and the county didn't show their attempt to reunify. That was never the intention. Not allowing any parenting time, supervised or otherwise, at any point doesn't show a willingness to lead to reunification. And again, I think the one of the biggest factors here is the best interest component, because there is no definition of what best interest is. We supplant that it should be under the termination. And I understand that there was new case law that said it's not explicitly in there. However, without a definition, the closest best interest kind of factors that have been described are under the termination standard. The other set would be under 518.175, which have nothing to do with juvenile protection. They are under the divorce. Other than that, those are the only two places in which I've ever seen a definition of best interest and how they should play out. The fact is, since we don't have a proper definition, the court can never make truly proper findings because we don't have it defined. And what we would do is leave such broad discretion as to create just if the words best interest are in there, therefore the district court has met its burden. And that's not appropriate under an abuse of discretion standard. We need a clear definition.
But that's not what the district court order is here. I mean, this is a well-crafted order from the district court with very detailed factual findings, a exhaustive procedural history, and conclusions that are drawn from those findings. And I mean, are you challenging the factual accuracy of any of these findings, that they're clearly erroneous? I mean, the district court does have discretion to assess the circumstances here.
Your Honor, we agree that the court has the absolute right to address the circumstances. However, when in looking at the factors, even though there's exhaustive procedural history in there, it does not look at the factors in the way that they seem to be designed. Factor two specifically is concerning in that the fact how the court addressed the factor was more that appellant had a lack of cooperation in creating a case plan, not what the social services agency had done specifically and how they attempted reunification. That never really got addressed. And
how could they ever attempt reunification if he hasn't completed the recommended treatment here based upon the findings as to his conduct toward these children?
Your Honor, that's where we get into a Fifth Amendment issue and what we address in the second part, not only for ordering sex offender treatment at the beginning, but also ordering sex offender treatment to have potential parenting time. Specifically,
if we adopted that argument, that would seem to say in any circumstances where there's credible evidence that a child has been sexually abused by a parent, that the parent would have a right to refuse treatment and still be reunified with the child. There's probably 1,000 appellate cases that are totally contrary to that analysis. I mean, that may be a bit of an exaggeration, but it just doesn't seem to make sense to me that somehow the requirement of treatment to be reunified with the child is trumped by a Fifth Amendment right to refuse.
Your Honor, it's not a refusal of treatment. It's how you look at the treatment. And it wasn't just attending treatment. It was successfully completing it. I think those are two
Well, the treatment's no good if you haven't completed it. I can't imagine that any judge would find that.
Well, as per the court in regarding welfare of JGW 433 Northwest 2nd 885 Minnesota, it's a Minnesota Supreme Court case from 1989, it specifically says that you can't do that. You cannot compel therapy treatment that would require an appellant to incriminate himself.
Well, that's now, a if choice. They wanted to... The judge didn't compel it here. So that's a choice that your client can make, but it may have consequences on reunification. I don't see how do you have some authority that says that under those circumstances where there was no order here that he specifically admit what he did, but he did have to successfully complete treatment. Do you have authority that, would support the position that, you know, the fact that he elects to not complete treatment because he doesn't want to admit the conduct or can't admit the conduct somehow implicates the court's ability in a child protection matter?
It does, Your Honor, because as that case continues, when a state compels testimony by threatening to inflict potent sanctions unless the constitutional privilege is surrendered, the testimony is obtained in violation of the Fifth Amendment. By requiring him to successfully complete, which requires admissions, he would never be able to do it. And the potent sanction is a potential termination or transfer of your custody of your children, which is an absolute, it's part of the privileges that we have. It is a constitutional privilege.
But the district court found, the district court specifically made a finding that he was not terminated from treatment because he refused to incriminate himself. In paragraph 32 of the district court's order, the district court credited the testimony of Ms. Oliver, who testified that the discharge was not solely based on the unwillingness to admit any wrongdoing, but it occurred because he didn't go to treatment. He didn't return to treatment. So when he says, I'm done with treatment, he's discharged. That doesn't have anything to do with whether he's willing or able to or required to incriminate himself.
I understand that the judge gave credit to Ms. Oliver's testimony, but Ms. Oliver also made testimony that she did not understand the full requirements of sex offender treatment. She did understand that part of the requirements would be potential admissions. Again, the issue comes in the fact that the court is certainly allowed to say you do need to do sex offender treatment, but to hinge a person's right to their children, either in a transfer or in a termination proceeding, you are implicating the Fifth Amendment when you do that. And the court could have crafted it
It only implicates the Fifth Amendment if the state compels your client to incriminate himself. And I don't see anything in any of these orders where the district court says you must admit to wrongdoing for you to have access to your children. It says you have to go to treatment.
Your Honor, he basically used it as a way to create that. In regarding the welfare of the child, JP, which is not a it's an unpublished case from 2006. The citation is Westlaw 3290624. It's a November 14th, 2006 case. The court ordered case plan directed certain evaluations and assessments to occur, and that's what it did. However, not admitting to the facts formed a basis for the initial removal. Now, while the judge didn't explicitly say it formed the basis, it used the fact that a non-successful completion of sex offender treatment, and I see my time is up. May I finish?
Thank you. Finish your answer, Ms. Olson.
Thank you. That the non-successful completion of it was one of the reasons why the transfer should occur, because he wasn't making himself amenable to the case plan. It also then became a requirement to at any point potentially see his children. And that's where the Fifth Amendment is now again becoming in place, because you are creating a sanction to him going forward. And the issue we now have is we have a pending criminal case on the pornographic images. If he's found not guilty, we have now become a catch-22 situation, because he'd never be able to admit to that. And I would note that the county never waived usage of this in a criminal trial, which they could have done. They could have surrendered their right and said, you know, we need this. This is important. And that's happened in other cases, and they chose not to do so. And I would reserve my right for rebuttal so I can further answer the questions if needed.
All right. Thanks, Corey. Could I ask one question?
You may.
In the record, it shows that social services was relieved of the obligation to continue with the case plan. And I don't see any objection to that. Did he ever object to the county being relieved of responsibility under the case plan?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe we ever relieved that that issue from what I know.
You didn't object to that, right?
He did not specifically object to it. I think what ended up happening was more, they never actually requested a relief from reunification though. So that effort, which is more of the finding that we need to worry about, would come into play. Relieving a need for a case plan doesn't mean that requirements can't be imposed upon him, and they did, and he followed those requirements. So I still
believe— By not objecting to the county being relieved of following the case plan, doesn't he forfeit any objection to that?
No, Your Honor. Reunification and case plans are two separate things. You can make case plans without approval from a party, especially in CHIPS cases, that isn't a requirement. And I believe under the termination statute, you are explicitly required to get reunification efforts relieved, and they chose not to do though in this matter.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, Ms. Jensen, you may proceed on behalf of the respondent.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, opposing counsel, my name is Jill Jensen and I represent the respondent, Brown County Human Services. The issue in this case is solely whether the district court made findings of fact that are sustained by the evidence and whether those conclusions of law are sustained by the findings of fact. In this case, the district court made an extensively detailed 19-page order considering the four factors for which it is required to make detailed findings under Minnesota Statute 260C.517. First, the district court made findings of fact, which were supported by the evidence as to how the children's best interests were served by the order. That can be seen in sections I apologize. Paragraphs 35 to 34 explicitly centered on the best interests of the children. The court considered that child one had been bullied at school because of respondent father's conduct, that child two had stopped participating in basketball and also been bullied because of respondent, the appellant's conduct. He also considered that the three youngest children all have developmental disabilities and receive extensive services, making them vulnerable children. But he also considered that child five, child three, and child four did want to have some contact with their father, and a transfer of custody could allow that to occur in the future. Secondly, the court considered the reasonable efforts made by the agency. And at this point, I would note that I did file a notice of motion and motion to be relieved of efforts on the basis of futility on April 29th of 2020. We did not receive a trial until June of 2020. I would agree that appellant waived that argument because he didn't object to the county's motion to be relieved of reasonable efforts. Specifically, I don't think the court even needed to, or this court needs to address whether reasonable efforts were made and the nature of those efforts, because the court did find that reasonable efforts to rehabilitate the appellant would be futile under the circumstances. With respect to the findings made with respect to the nature of efforts and the appellant's ability to use it, the court made findings supported by the evidence that he was, he delayed completing the psychosexual evaluation, which was not changed by the county. It was actually a recommendation of the facility that did the parental capacity assessment. They recommended a psychosexual.
So it appears to me that he eventually got around to completing the psychological assessment, but that results were unable to be produced because he declined to answer certain questions. Is that correct?
They did have ultimate recommendations, but some of the testing matrices that they utilized were, I think one's called like the million something, or psychometric testing. He didn't answer some of the questioning.
Were those questions that he declined to answer questions that would have required him to incriminate himself?
Not to my knowledge, Your Honor. And I do believe this Fifth Amendment issue to be rather a red herring, in that this is not a case in which he invoked his Fifth Amendment rights, or he was required to admit anything. This is a case in which the appellant admitted on the record and in his emails that he's in love with a 10-year-old child, and asked to meet her at midnight. The appellant in this case readily admitted to all of that. The issue, which the district court found, was that he does not believe that's an issue. So
Ms. Jensen, were Fifth Amendment objections ever made at the district court level?
No. The appellant testified at his first child protection trial that he would do a psychosexual evaluation. It was raised multiple times before the district court, the district court ordered him to complete a psychosexual and addressed it. At that time, he did not raise any objections. The first time I heard of it was in the proposed findings of fact, which stated that it could have raised a Fifth Amendment issue. So I do believe that is waived. And I also don't believe, even if Your Honors did need to address it, that it is an issue in this case, because again, he already made admissions that were incriminating.
So the first time, I'll just frame it as the issue of the Fifth Amendment was raised, was in the proposed findings that were submitted by father?
To my recollection, that is accurate.
Okay, and that proposed finding is what generated the statement in paragraph 42 of the district court's order about the potential for incrimination?
Well, I should say, Your Honor, at trial, Ms. Olson, or opposing counsel, did ask several questions that were, I believe, intended to elicit whether or not he had asserted a Fifth Amendment right, but it was never established in testimony that he actually asserted a Fifth Amendment right. what occurred was there was questions on whether are you required to make admissions as part of treatment. Yes, sometimes you are, but again, that wasn't an issue here because he had already admitted it. If that makes sense. So, and I should say, regardless, I think even if this court were to find that reasonable efforts were not made or something of the sort, I don't think that doesn't preclude a finding that transfer of permanent legal and physical custody should occur. There's an unpublished case, JMP, which I cited in my brief, that indicates that these are the four factors the court needs to make detailed findings on and take into consideration in making its ultimate conclusion, but it's not a requirement that all of them were made. Finally, with respect to the fourth finding, the district court made findings which were again supported by the evidence that the appellant in this case is unable to correct the issues that came before this court, specifically because he does not realize they are an issue, that is supported by the testimony of both the guardian ad litem and the social worker, that even as recently as April of 2020, prior to trial, when the social worker met with the appellant, she asked if there were any services that could assist him. At that time, he had already been discharged unsuccessfully from sex offender treatment, and he did not believe there were any services that could assist him. And as you'll note, that is consistent with the psychosexual evaluation, which found that he has delusional and narcissistic disorder, which was an ongoing issue throughout this case. And then going back to the question about, from here, Your Honor, all of those findings that the district court made that were very extensive, they support the conclusion that transfer of legal and physical custody to the children's mother is in the children's best interest. With respect to visitation and contact conditions imposed, I've argued that he waived the right to contest that. He never raised that issue with the district court. He never filed a post-trial motion. As a result, Your Honor, I believe this... I believe that all of the district court's findings were extremely supported by the evidence that was taken from the court, including its own findings of fact from the child, the adjudication trial in which the appellant testified. And all of those findings support its order that transfer of custody is in the children's best interest. So as a result, I would respectfully request that you affirm the district court's order. If you have any other questions of me, I'm able to take them at this time.
Seeing none, thank you, Ms. Jensen. Ms. Olson, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal. I'll note you're muted, Ms. Olson.
Technology, I'm sorry.
We do it in every single hearing we do that, so don't feel singled out here.
Well, I feel in good company then. The issue that the respondent is making, again, is saying, well, because he's a bad guy and we all feel he's a bad guy, the transfer should occur. That's not what the case law and the statute is designed for. The relieving of reunification efforts, if I reviewed the procedural history, is that I believe the court never made a decision on that until the trial itself. So from that time, reunification was still a requirement. And from what they wanted, what the state wanted was for him to complete sex offender treatment. That could have been done very simply. They could have agreed that any statements he made during his treatment would not be used against him. They chose not to do that.
So what do you make of Ms. Jensen's position that there was nothing about the treatment or the evaluations that would have required your client to incriminate himself beyond the statements and the admissions that he had already made?
That's simply incorrect.
Where is that in the record? is there anything in the record that says that there's something in addition to the admissions that had already been made that would have been required of your client?
Your Honor, there's nothing in the record because lie detector tests and admissions of those lie detectors were not used because they're not supposed to be. So there isn't anything in the record. However, what is in the record is neither the social worker nor the guardian ad litem could properly identify what would be specifically required to successfully complete sex offender treatment. They do know because of the lie detector test that that treatment became unsuccessful. It's important to note that the guardian ad litem basically said if he, regarding the admission specifically, that if he had he could have admitted and he could have moved on and got closer to his children. And that's the crucial factor in this case. He couldn't have. The case regarding the gross misdemeanor with the other child is not a sex offense. It had nothing to do with a sex offense. It was whether or not the child would have been made a runaway or put in a dangerous environment. And that actually has been up to the Court of Appeals, got remanded, and now is actually at the Minnesota Supreme Court. We just had an argument, I believe two weeks ago, on whether or not he would be convicted of that. Again, admissions could create a potential problem for him because we were in the appellate process at that time. The pornographic felony is still pending. And if the crucial thing for the county was for him to complete sex offender treatment and move on and to help reunify, they simply could have made it something that was not admissible. It could have been something that they addressed, and it's their responsibility not to implicate him. He doesn't have a requirement to say, I'm invoking my Fifth Amendment right. That's not a requirement for him specifically. The requirement and the reason why the implication can happen is if the state is compelling him to do something, whether he does it or not is not the issue. It's whether the state has implicitly done it. There's no requirement that it's explicit. And they did. They said, you have to do a psychosexual and follow the recommendations. When the recommendations became sex offender treatment, the request was successful completion of sex offender treatment. He couldn't successfully complete it. And he won't ever be able to successfully complete it, especially if he is found innocent of the crime.
I mean, there are plenty of people who are charged with a sex offense who enter sex offender treatment before trial or a plea and maintain their privilege against self-incrimination. There are ways to do that. And I'm just wondering what it is about this particular treatment that was ordered by the district court that would have required your client, what specifically would have required your client to not be able to do that, not be able to preserve his Fifth Amendment privilege? Where is that in the record?
Your Honor, and I'm seeing I'm going to run out of time, so I'm just going to ask ahead of time, can I respond fully?
Go ahead.
Thank you. It's not explicitly in the record because we couldn't fully address the sex offender issue because it implicated a lie detector test.
I mean, you could have made an offer of proof.
We could have made an offer of proof. The state also could have offered proof that he wasn't being implicated because they could have made an offer of proof on what was said, and they chose not to as well. It's their burden, not our burden, to supplement whether sex offender treatment or not. They have to prove by clear and convincing evidence that a transfer is appropriate, and we use the four factors, and they chose not to do so. It would create a significant burden on appellant to prove that he wouldn't have been able to successfully complete without this Fifth Amendment issue. I think, again, though, when we're weighing all these factors, there isn't a requirement necessarily to weight them slightly individually, but you are supposed to use them all. And while this is an extensive order, there's no doubt 19 pages is a long order. That doesn't mean that the facts that were found were sufficient to create a transfer. It's just not. And the Fifth Amendment issue is not just an issue for the order itself. It's for going forward making a requirement like that really imposes a burden upon appellant that could incriminate him in the future and is not an appropriate, requirement for him to potentially see his children in the future, especially based on the other factors and the other findings that the kids want to see him.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Olson. And thank you, counsel, for your arguments and your briefing in this matter. It was helpful to the court. The matter is now submitted to this court. We will take it under advisement and we'll issue a decision within the statutory period. With that, we stand adjourned.